Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Charlie Jane Anders, author of this, her new novel, The City in the Middle of the Night, published in February by Tor. She's the organizer of the Writers with Drinks series and was a founder of IO9, a website about sci-fi, science, and futurism that I would highly recommend. I've even gotten all the back issues that I paid a lot for. Her stories have appeared in Asimov Science Fiction, the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, Lightspeed, Tin House, and lots of anthologies. And her novel, before this one, 6 Months, 3 Days, which I'm in the middle of now, won a Hugo Award. So anyway, The City in the Middle of the Night explores a land where night and day, miserable and extremely hot and cold nights and days, compete with each other, while a very narrow perimeter allows a scrappy but flawed civilization, which claws out an existence more than subsistence but less than bucolic. This is because the planet is rotationally locked with its sun, just as our moon is rotationally locked with our planet, which is why we see only one side of the moon and have no idea what the other side looks like, other than the recent Chinese lunar lander. So, a mothership has left our dying planet for a generations-long trip to this planet, January, the name of the planet, not knowing what will be found there. And as the new residents try to create a habitable world, the mothership revolves slowly up above, mythologized and revered. So the cold war of two cities on this planet formed the loose thread of this novel. Two women, in my opinion, almost lovers, very close friends, have a relationship which evolves, as does this war, over the course of this book. The two protagonists are joined with a panoply of well-drawn peripheral friends as each faction tries to achieve control or power over the other. Added to this story is that of an alien life, misunderstood by some, but embraced, literally and figuratively, by the hero of our story. So with that somewhat lengthy introduction, welcome, Charlie, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So it seems like just yesterday, but I interviewed Anna Lee, your partner for Autonomous, and I didn't realize it, but it was back in 2017.
Yeah, oh my God, I love Autonomous. It's such a great book, and I know Anna Lee had a wonderful time talking to you.
Yeah, it's like, and all both of you are blurbed by, like, the greatest people. Doesn't that make you feel great? I mean, like, by Neal Stephenson?
I mean, I'm very grateful that people were generous enough to do that. And, like, you know, the thing with blurbs is you always just hope, you put out your feelers and you hope that if even one or two of these people get back to you with a quote, then you'll be good. And I was really just overjoyed that so many people got back to me about this book, and you know, that was just a wonderful surprise. I think you know, it's people are very generous. It's really nice.
And yeah, and I can tell you, obviously you really like science fiction, and especially in the book when you're talking about Highlands, how space suit will travel, because I remember going to the library when I was like 12 years old and getting that book and being so, you know, just so amazed by it, that I read everything by Highland, by Bradbury, by Theodore Sturgeon, by Clifford Simak, all those guys, and I imagine you did something similar too.
But, yeah, I mean, I read a lot of that stuff when I was a kid. I actually read a lot of Clifford Simak and a lot of A. Van Vogt, and yeah, and just, you know, obviously Le Guin and Madeleine L'Engle kind of got me started when I was pretty young. I love stories of exploration. I love stories of, you know, problem solving and figuring stuff out and, you know, heroic scientists and heroic explorers. That's like totally my jam. I love that stuff.
Hey, were you working on this book at the same time that Anna Lee was working on Autonomous in the same house?
I mean, I think that there was probably some overlap. I think Autonomous was a book, I mean, it's complicated because I think Anna Lee had been working on Autonomous for a very long time and had kind of put it aside for various at various times. And, I started working on The City in the Middle of the Night, I guess in late 2013 or early 2014. And yeah, I'm pretty sure that Autonomous was still kind of in the pipeline at that point.
That's interesting. I mean, I wonder if you shared, like, kind of like, here's where I am, here, where are you, stuff like that. I have no idea.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that we definitely had lots of conversations. We always have lots of conversations that shape what we're both working on. And it's, you know, there's a back and forth that goes on about what we're doing and how we're doing it. And I definitely talked to her about my Totally Locked Planet. And, like, you know, I think Anna Lee might have been the person who suggested what became the Sea of Murder, that kind of, like, deadly, you know, somewhat kind of a very dramatic ocean with the frozen inside and the wall of steam on the other side.
Yeah, actually, let's talk about the book because we're here to sell books. So,
yeah.
So yeah, okay, so you got this rotationally locked planet that only shows one side to the sun and one side to the vacuum of space. Do you really think it's feasible? And can you explain the premise of the book about how, because this is so cinematic in a way, how they could eke out an existence with each side being totally different? What was this area where they could live, and how did they go about doing it?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so backing up slightly, a lot of astronomers have been saying that planets that humans can live on outside of our solar system are very likely to be tidally locked. If you look at the planets that we've discovered that are in the habitable zone of their sun, they tend to be tidally locked. And that's partly because I think something like 3/4 of the stars in our part of the galaxy are red dwarfs, which are cooler. And so to be close enough to have the warmth, to have liquid water, and to have all the other stuff that humans need, you would need to be so close that you get pulled into a tidally locked orbit. That's my understanding. And so it's part of what this book came from is realizing that, yeah, we are likely to have to go live on a tidally locked planet if we leave Earth, if we leave this solar system. That's where we're going to end up. And, you know, I've talked to a bunch of scientists about what that would be like, and there are different theories about it. One theory that you do hear a lot is that humans would just live in the kind of strip of twilight or you know, dusk between the day side and the night side, which is what happens in my novel. And, you know, you could use the differential between the two, the day side and the night side, to generate energy, like geothermal energy. You could, you know, take advantage of the fact that water is traveling from one side to the other and use that in various ways. You know, there it really depends on how stable the planet's climate is and how, you know, what kind of wind jets it has in the atmosphere that are going to redistribute heat from the day side to the night side, so that it doesn't, you know, the temperature differential doesn't get so great that you can't have liquid water, or so that you can't have, you know, a breathable atmosphere. There are certain things that have to be exactly right for humans to be able to live there. And it's possible that if those things were exactly right, we actually might even be able to live on the day side, because it might be, you know, it might not be too hot for us. In my book, humans can't live on the day side, in part because it's too hot, and in part because the sunlight is actually toxic. It has, you know, there's no ozone layer, and so direct sunlight burns you really badly. And but I think that, you know, colonizing any planet outside of our solar system is going to be a huge challenge. It's going to require a lot of just digging in and, you know, trying to create something sustainable. And, you know, what I think is realistic in my novel is that a lot of the technology that humans bring with us to this other planet ends up not working over, you know, the humans have been on the planet for probably about 500 years, Earth time. And over that time, some of our technology has stopped working. We can't replace all the parts for, you know, our computers and our super high-tech machines, because, you know, that requires a really advanced post-industrial civilization to keep making these, you know, circuit boards and, you know, whatever the nanotech things that they have in the future. And it's a very different challenge. And so humans are able to maintain a technological civilization, but not the level that they had when they came.
It's what's exciting about and provides so many good plot movement devices is the fact that you're always in danger. You know, Sophie is freezing to death when she's, I don't want to give spoilers away, but Sophie's freezing to death, and, you know, then they have to worry when they're out on the water that they're going to get burned to death, and it's just, you know, they have a very thin line. Most people have a thin line figuratively, but they really have a thin line literally, and they always have to keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, and I actually think, you know, I mean, it's not like they're always in danger. Like, when they're in a city, like, when they're, most of the time in the book, they're inside one of the two human cities, or I guess eventually the alien city. And inside the city, they're relatively safe. Like, it's relatively comfortable, and you can just go out and party and you know, go about your life and process your emotions and do everything else. It's more just that even when you're inside a city with all the safety that that provides, there's still an awareness that, you know, the environment is very deadly and in places that are not that far away, and that, you know, you're constantly surrounded by, like, this eternal darkness on the one side and this eternal blazing light on the other, and you're kind of caught between the two of them, and that never stops. And that was kind of the thing that I was fascinated by in the book, was just, what would that be like being on a tidally locked planet and having, you know, eternal darkness and eternal blazing light be constantly there and constantly in the same location? Like, you can just walk from one to the other and you know exactly where they are at all times. I thought that was a super fascinating thing to kind of focus on.
Talk about how the ordered city, the city that lived like one of the cities on Earth with, you know, orderly movement and orderly day-to-day jobs. Talk about that shutter system that they used to keep their city habitable, and the, you know, the time things.
So backing up slightly, my theory was that basically, you know, they came here on this mothership. The mothership, obviously, you know, they were traveling for probably up to 100 years, maybe, on the mothership coming from Earth, this generation ship. And the ship would have had some kind of artificial day-night cycle. Like, there would have been ship's day and ship's night. And everybody would have been very aware that it was artificial, and that, you know, when they dim the lights at certain times and everybody tries to sleep, it's just an artificial system that the ship has. And then they arrive on this planet, and on this planet, there's the sun never rises or sets. The sky always looks exactly the same. They don't even have the dimming of the lights that they had on the ship. They don't have anything to kind of give them a sense of day and night. And I think over time they kind of freak out about this because, you know, are we still human if we don't have our circadian rhythms? Are we still human if we don't all sleep at the same time and work at the same time? You know, what does it mean for the human species if we are just, you know, living on a place that doesn't have this basic thing that we take for granted? And so they institute this policy, which gets more draconian as time goes by, that basically says that everybody has to be in their homes, and there are shutters that close and enclose and encase them in perfect darkness. And, you know, they have to stay in the dark for what would be the equivalent of 8 hours or something. And then everybody has to go work at the same time. And they also have this complicated economic system that makes it so that people have to really hustle to get all the money that they need for the various things. And that's kind of by design, almost, to keep people, you know, rushing around while they're awake. And it's, you know, it's a little bit, I was worried that it was too dystopian, but I thought it was actually realistic for how people might kind of try to adapt to this very different environment. And then, you know, there's the other city, which was founded by people who kind of rebelled against the people from the first city. And the second city, Argillo, is kind of a place where they kind of went to the opposite extreme, and anybody can do whatever they want. And you can sleep when you feel like it. You can work when you feel like it. You know, everybody just keeps their own schedule. And it's a very energetic place where lots and lots of stuff is happening. But over time, it's kind of gone from being like a very, you know, orderly anarchist collective to being just kind of chaos.
Hey, that reminds me, all the food sucked.
I don't know about that.
No, none of it was any good. Because, you know, what was name a food there that was good?
I mean, people keep asking me about cactus pork crisps, which is the thing that you eat in Argyllo. There's a lot of nice food. There's cakes. CS Fun has really nice cakes. There's, like, really nice breads. They grow a lot of grains on these, like, food, these farm wheels that they have in CS Fun. And they have a lot of good baked goods in CS Fun. They have a lot of, you know, tasty skewers with, like, roast pigeon on them in Argyllo. There's a lot of nice food in that book.
I have to go back and look at it because it was just all swamp gin and people almost throwing up when they ate something. But I don't know.
Oh, there's a little bit of throwing up in the book, but that's more existential than anything else, I think. And the swamp gin doesn't sound that bad to me. It actually sounds, I don't know. The swamp vodka. There's swamp vodka and then there's gin and milk.
Oh, gin and milk.
I think gin and milk is supposed to be kind of gross.
Yeah. That would be. And I hate gin anyway. And it gives me a horrible hangover.
Oh, okay.
So, I might have just missed this, but why the name January for the planet?
I mean, it was kind of an obvious thing because January, Janus is this great Roman god, I guess, who has two faces. The planet has two faces, the day side and the night side. Plus, it has this implication of we're kind of starting over.
Got it. Okay. So, if we go to the main characters, and again, without trying to say too much, but you have Sophie, who is this very shy young lady, and you have Bianca, who's like the homecoming queen, head of the cheerleading squad, and they have this, and they have this relationship that is kind of one side worshipful and blah, blah, blah. But how the thing about it is you, and this is really good the way you did this because other books would have gone a different way. How did you make their relationship so close without stepping over that line, if you will, without me saying what the line is?
Like, you know, romance or...
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of a romantic friendship. And, you know, Sophie is kind of in love with Bianca, I think. And that was something that I wondered about how far to push that in terms of, you know, making it explicit that Sophie's in love with Bianca. And I think in the very last round of revisions, I decided to just go for it and make it very clear that Sophie's in love with Bianca because it didn't really work otherwise, as far as I was concerned. And it was basically, it was this combination of you kind of have your first, it's the first time you fall in love with someone or your first, like, really serious crush, and it happens to be on your roommate who's kind of straight. But also it was just, you know, I mean, where it kind of came from for me was that early in the book, this isn't really a spoiler, Sophie makes a sacrifice for Bianca, which turns out to be a much bigger deal than she was expecting. And I needed to kind of believe that she would do that. And so that really meant that the bond between them had to be really huge and important. And, you know, I don't think it's entirely one-sided. I think Bianca really loves and cares about Sophie too. And, you know, in her own fashion, lights, Bianca tries to be there for Sophie and actually is really good to Sophie a lot of the time. It's just that there are things that they can't kind of get over, I think.
Yeah, and that transition was really well done, and that's kind of why, how can I put this? That's kind of why the book kind of begs for a sequel.
Oh, wow.
Don't you think? I mean, it does for me.
I mean, I actually don't think of it as setting up a sequel at all. I kind of think of it as very self-contained, which...
Really?
So it kind of surprises me when people say that it needs a sequel.
I don't know. It's like, okay, yeah, I see... Okay, I see what happened, but it's almost like, let's put things right. How are we going to get together and put things right? You know, that's now I'm kind of spoiling it. Anyway, that's the way I thought of it. I mean, there's two ways of looking at at almost any book. You know, you can look at it like my brother does, which is, you know, he wants the book to be over put in a box, wrapped up with gift paper and, you know, ribbon around it with a bow. And I don't like those. I like when the reader has to think, wow, I wonder what happens next. I wonder what they're going to do. Did I read this right? Is this what's happening now? That's the kind of book I like. And I felt that way.
Yeah,
about
me too.
I
like that too. I like a book that kind of makes you kind of think for a minute when you put it down, maybe. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think you should make the reader do some work, really. That's the way I look at it.
I mean, I think that final page, without giving any spoilers, the kind of the thing that happens between Sophie and Alyssa, you can kind of see how a new situation has kind of has been set up, kind of.
Well, I think one that has to be resolved, but you don't. But, you know, it's up to you.
I might write a short story. There's always, like, you know, a certain amount of leeway to write a short story that just kind of follows some of the characters a little bit further.
Yeah, well, it's like if Anna Lee really does have this series coming up based on hers, you could do the same thing, but then you'd have to be like George R. R. Martin and just keep going, you know?
Right.
Which is hard.
Yeah, I mean, that would be amazing, obviously.
Yeah, it would be. And it is very cinematic, and it would probably cost a bunch of money to make because of the planet. But, it's very cinematic, and you pick some really cool people to be in it. But who knows? Maybe it'll happen. It's funny because I'm a 66-year-old white man, and for some reason I kept looking at Mouse as a man. I couldn't, every time I... Because, first of all, he has this non-gender name. She has this non-gender name. And it just seemed like her actions, I don't know, this is totally a bias. It's wrong thinking. But it just seemed like, you know, Sophie and Bianca are clearly what they are, but it just seemed to me like Mouse was like this cat burglar. And it seemed masculine to me. And I wonder why I did that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Mouse is a very stereotypically, like... Mouse starts out, at least, as a very stereotypically male character, the kind of tough smuggler who, you know, has killed, you know, more people than she's eaten breakfast or whatever. You know, she's kind of a tough-as-nails, hardened smuggler. And, you know, writing that character as a woman was something that I actually was really interested in. And, you know, I think of Mouse as being a little bit gender nonconforming in some ways, but I didn't want to make that explicit in the book because Mouth already has this huge identity crisis where she doesn't really know who she really is. And I thought that, you know, making that linked to a fluid or non-standard gender identity might imply that, you know, people with whose genders aren't fixed or aren't, you know, standard are suffering from an identity crisis, and so I kind of didn't want to do that. But I think that Mouth is, hopefully Mouth has a lot of different layers and, you know, goes beyond any archetype, especially once you get deeper into the book and she's not acting like that character anymore. But she was a lot of fun to write. She was a really fun character to write. And having, you know, she was the one who surprised me, like, more than anybody else in this book. Like, just the things that happened to her and the things that she does just kept surprising me.
And also surprising her. When you say she had many different layers, she actually realizes that she does. And that's what was cool about it is, you know, the self-reflection that she had. You know, maybe I'm like this, or maybe I'm like this, or can I be like this? And that was fascinating. You know, you don't often have that kind of almost...
Thanks. I mean...
Yeah. Interior monologue almost.
I mean... Yeah, I mean, part of what was made Mouth fun to write is that she tells this story about herself that's clearly not true, and that, you know, she's kind of unaware of how false the stories she tells about herself are. And, you know, she sort of realizes over the course of the book that everything she's been telling herself about herself is actually kind of a lie.
Yeah, and the way you began it was, you know, and then people end up hating her or not hating her or eventually not hating her. But the thing is, the way you began it is good because, you know, there's this thing called the invention, and she wants it more than anything, and she wants it for a very noble reason, But in order to get it, you know, she has to do some things that she doesn't really like doing, but she just puts them aside. And then it moves on from there. And I think that was a really good way to start it. So speaking of starting it, why did you decide to open it up with this, like, I can't remember if it was even italicized, but just like Robinson Crusoe or one of those books or Gulliver's Travels, why did you start it out with this preface that made it seem like, okay, here's this manuscript that follows that's been translated as well as it can be, but we apologize for having to use some words when in actuality they aren't the proper words. Why did you start it that way instead of just starting it from the beginning of the novel?
Yeah, I was really excited about the translator's note. That was one of the first things that I decided to do, because partly because I didn't want to have a bunch of vocabulary words that people were going to have to struggle with, and character names that people were going to have to struggle to pronounce. I mean, we have there's the two cities that have names that are hard to pronounce, but everything else in the book pretty much is easy to pronounce. And I was like, well, instead of having like a bunch of words, because I don't think people would be speaking English in whatever the 33rd century, whenever this takes place. They wouldn't be speaking English. They wouldn't be speaking anything remotely close to English, which means that all the names for things would also be not anywhere close to English names, and they would be really hard to pronounce. And so I wanted to have it that, you know, basically this book had been translated into English, and we were using the English words for things, even if it wasn't the exact word. And so instead of having some, like, strange creature that we have, like, we give a name with, like, five consonants and a bunch of stuff to, we just call it a cat or a bison. And we just have pagers, and we just have, you know, lorries. And we have, you know, everything has basically an earth name and a name from, like, 20th century English. Even if it doesn't exactly describe what the thing is, it's kind of, it takes some liberties. So that was part of it. I wanted to kind of leave a little bit of a question mark in the reader's mind as to whether this translation was completely accurate, and, you know, just kind of screw with that sense of, you know, how much you can trust the text, which I think is always a good thing to have in this kind of story. And, you know, also, the other good thing about the translator's note is that it's the only kind of hint we get of, like, the larger context of the story and, you know, maybe what happens after the story. Like, if you want more closure or more kind of where this is going, the translator's note basically tells you how the story ends up to some extent, and what the results of Sophie's actions are going to be, like, you know, in the future of this novel. And so it kind of does that, but it's mostly just, and, you know, the thing of having, like, you know, a strange, bizarre creature with tentacles and all this other stuff that we call a crocodile felt like a fun way to kind of mess with people's expectations and, you know, give them, you know, something that seems familiar but then turns out not to be familiar, and to kind of destabilize that so that people are kind of kept off their guard a little bit.
Also, I think it makes it confusing, but in a good way, as to the temporal aspect of the novel. Is this translator's note written years or scores of years after these things happened, and the translator's looking back on this manuscript that was written when the events occurred, and you know, and then that was like a precursor of what happened, again, going back to my sequel thing, a precursor of what happened afterwards. These are the heroes that caused what happened to our society some years ago, and we're living in the future and we're remembering them, you know? At least I looked at it that way a little bit. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what I intended, for sure.
Okay. So going back to Sophie and Bianca and their relationship. So it's interesting, like we were talking about, Bianca, like, was so beautiful from the curve of her neck to her hair to her eyes to her body to everything. And it's interesting because every once in a while, you would stick in there something that made you think that Sophie was beautiful as well. but only once in a while, you know? So you had this idea. I have in my head an idea of what Bianca looked like. But with Sophie, all I know is that she kept her beauty to herself, and I only know that she was beautiful from like one or two references in the book. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Sophie is very shy and very kind of insecure and doesn't really know how she comes across to other people most of the time. And she's very good at fading into the background and kind of not being the center of attention. She is kind of the opposite of, it's like that old, you know, music video with Paula Abdul and MC Scat Cat, Opposites Attract. You know, Bianca and Sophie are kind of opposites, and they do kind of come together because they're you know, because of their opposition. And so it was like, I don't know, it was interesting to play with that dynamic. I think that Sophie definitely is, you know, way more, I mean, she's, I think that people, when the people really see her, they see something special in her. And that, you know, it's just that she sometimes kind of doesn't get noticed because she's so quiet. And she's somebody who kind of, because she's not from the same social class as Bianca, and because she has a lot of imposter syndrome around that, she tends to just kind of keep to herself. But, you know, the events of the story kind of push her into the spotlight. And she, I think people do, like Mouth definitely thinks that Sophie is amazing.
Yeah, and part of it is like, maybe her beauty is transmitted by the fact that she has all these incredible qualities underneath, you know, like a person who might not otherwise seem incredibly attractive is simply because of the person they are, which happens a lot, you know, in life, you know? What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, so, yeah, it's like, in my mind, I do have an idea of what Bianca looked like, but I don't know if it's right, but I know exactly what she looked like. It was kind of like, I don't know, a young Charlize Theron or something like that. but I don't have an idea about Sophie. I can't get a picture of her, but I do have this idea that, you know, she was... And the other thing about her being shy is that... and being quiet and not really talking unless there was something to say, is that she learned a lot from being quiet. And that was a good object lesson for me, because you've listened to me now and hear how much I talk. But, you know, it's amazing how much you can learn by being quiet.
Yeah, and that was part of, like, I kind of... There were definitely versions of this book where I played that up more, the idea that Sophie kind of becomes a spy.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the thing where she follows Mouth around, you know, I had her following people around a lot. Like, she follows Bianca a little bit, too.
Yeah.
But I had her just following random people and discovering, like, all these secrets. And, you know, in one version, there was a, you know, there was a spy from Argilo hiding out in Ciasfont, and Sophie discovered this person and spied on them. And, you know, I like the idea that, like, because Sophie works in this coffee house where she's sort of trained to watch people and to kind of pay attention to all the little cute clues they give to what's really going on with them, she kind of becomes really good at watching people and at observing. And she's, you know, able to kind of be around a lot of people who don't even really pay attention to her. But she's, you know, I think that that's the thing that I always love, is the thing of the person who is just kind of, you know, they're kind of hiding in plain sight, being, you know, quiet in the background, but actually watching everything and learning everything and kind of discovering everybody's secrets without them even noticing that she's there, kind of.
Yeah, and then without giving away spoilers from your other book, reminds me a little bit of, I won't give his name, but the assassin, you know?
Theodolphus. Yeah,
yeah,
a little bit different. I don't think Theodolphus is shy. I think Theodolphus is just, you know, very, very good at being sneaky, but, you know, also kind of a sociopath.
Yeah, but he is very stealthy, though, especially when he's in, you know, working in school as a counselor. That book was great. Talk about what anchor banter is and why you called it that, because it's never really defined as such, but you know it exists, and you know it exists between certain people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I kind of started from this place where Sophie and Bianca come to the city of Argilo, where they don't really, you know, they don't speak the language and they don't really understand the customs, and they're trying to make their way, and, you know, part of that is understanding all of these, like, cultural concepts that don't have any exact translation into Siosanti, the language that they speak. And, you know, just like how the Germans have Schadenfreude and, you know, Japanese is full of concepts that are hard to translate into English. I wanted there to be concepts like that in Argilon. And so I hit on this thing which kind of just developed over time that Sophie doesn't know what it is. She knows it's pronounced like Anker Banter, but she doesn't know what it means. And, you know, over time she kind of gets more inklings, and then she finally kind of, Alyssa, who's one of the few people in the book who's really bilingual in both Siosfanti and Argilon, finally gives her an explanation that kind of makes sense, which I don't know if I want to spoil it or not, but
yeah,
it's a thing that kind of ends up illuminating the relationship between Sophie and Mouth in a way that I thought was really fun. And that was one of the things that I just kind of, that just kind of came out of the story as I was writing it.
Yeah, and Alyssa and Mouse also, their relationship, and the other word that we know what it means, but it means a little bit different there, is the word jinx.
Right.
Yeah, here it has just...
But it's more complicated than that. It's almost like that the thing in Vonnegut, you know, where you have like somebody who's tied to you and you don't necessarily know them, but their fate is connected to yours or something.
Right.
I can't remember. There was a thing like that in Vonnegut.
Yeah. And he had tons of words like that from Grand Falloon on, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I forgot what the name of it is. It definitely has a name. So a lot of people have said that, you know, they call it hard science fiction, and that's when they compare it to, you know, Ursula Le Guin and stuff like that. So do you feel that's true, that it's similar to some of your inspirations in that way, that it's, you know, because so much new science fiction is like politically driven and it's in the near future, and it's more almost as if it could happen today, as opposed to the old days with like spacesuit will travel or Farmer in the Sky or something like that. Did you feel like when you were writing it that it was kind of like hard science fiction? Did you even think about it?
I mean, I don't know if it's actually hard science fiction, as some people just find that term. It's, you know, there are definitely some flights of fancy in there. There are some things where I did talk to some scientists and they kind of gave me ways to do things, but there were some things which I think are a little bit fanciful in the book. It's, you know, I would say that I definitely worked to get the science as right as I could, but I also worked to kind of imagine a world that felt internally consistent to me and that had, like, you know, that felt like a place that you could actually go to. I do think that this book is heavily influenced by kind of science fiction of the 1970s and before, like Le Guin, like Octavia Butler, and like, you know, a bunch of other, like, I guess people have mentioned Dune, which is a huge thing to be compared to, but it's definitely influenced by that kind of classic science fiction about people on another planet, you know, dealing with extremes circumstances and kind of an extreme environment. It's also influenced by books like The Book of Strange New Things by, I can't remember his name now, but it came out a few years ago. I love those kinds of thinky, big, idea-driven science fiction books from back in the day that kind of have an epic feeling but also just ask a lot of questions about what it means to be human and what makes us, you know, what makes us able to survive and have a society and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, with the crocodiles, that dreamy kind of sad, nostalgic, hearkening back, you know, this is what it was like. It reminded me of one of the stories in the Martian Chronicles. You remember?
Oh, neat. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's like.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I love that book, too. And, like, I think that that's the kind of stuff I feel like science fiction needs to take big swings, even if you don't always, you know, even if it doesn't always succeed. I think science fiction needs to kind of take big swings and try ambitious stuff that, you know, and that gets into, that kind of blurs that line between, like, part of what I love is blurring that line between, you know, real speculation about the future and kind of the kind of dreamy, surreal stuff that I think is part of what the future will, you know, when you go beyond what humans are used to, there will be that kind of dreamlike quality in some ways. I think that's like the Arthur C. Clarke thing, kind of.
Yeah, I agree. Well, actually, you know, on that note, this is a great time to close. We've been speaking for 45 minutes. I could keep going on, but that's a good way to close the conversation out, because it really explains, I think, what you were trying to go for. So,
cool.
Yeah. In any event, thank you so much for being here. Having both you and Anna Lee here has been a real pleasure for me, because you're both on the forefront, plus all the stuff you've done in the past, and that I've read and enjoyed, and like I said, you know, spent money on. It's all just great. You guys are geniuses.
Oh, well, thank you. So, well, that really means a lot to me. I really appreciate it. And thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me and having me on your show. This was great.
You're welcome. So, well, hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. As you can tell, I love science fiction, and it's a really good science fiction book. And her first book, her first novel, which, like I said, I'm right in the middle of reading. It's really good. You can't put it down, but I fell asleep while I was reading it, and then I dreamt about it. So, yeah, her first book. Hold on a second, because I forgot the title. Let's see. The title is 6 Months, 3 Days. And like I said, it won the Hugo Award, which is the most prestigious prize you can win in science fiction. And it's very accessible, but I don't know. It's like, say, like a Philip Pullman book, you know. There's, like, just kids in it and kids who grow up and all the challenges they face and magic and witches and all that kind of stuff. So I'd recommend that highly, too. But The City in the Middle of the Night is the book we talked about. Her partner is Anna Lee Newitz, and I interviewed her 2 years ago on her book, Autonomous. And together they've accomplished so many different things, from Io9 to just so many different, I don't know, magazines and online stuff, and just moved the genre so far forward in so many ways that I admire both of them a great deal. So, in any event, it was a pleasure having them, having Charlie on today and having Anna Lee on a couple of years ago. The reason I'm, like, kind of going back and forth is because I lost my notes, or I do this all the time. I kind of mix them all up. But here's the one that I always have, is to join us every week on the Avid Reader Show for, as I've always said, and because of my producer, Rebecca Albright, we always have insightful and engaging discussions, which today definitely was. And it's different, you know. It's not like Terry Gross. It's different. Whoever's listening out there, it's a different way of interviewing somebody. You may not learn a lot about the book because I'm questioning her about the book and you haven't read it yet. And that's why I try to keep the spoilers out down. So anyway, beside the point. Upcoming guests include New York Times bestselling author and the New Yorker copy chief and the self-professed comma queen, which I interviewed her for. Mary Norris is going to discuss her captivating new memoir, Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comic Queen. It's completely different, but she's just as funny. And then Pulitzer Prize winner finalist Susan Choi, who will discuss what's, as often is on the show, her highly anticipated new novel, Trust Exercise. And then celebrated therapist Lori Gottlieb will join us to discuss her latest book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. So we have a lot of good stuff coming up, plus there's a whole bunch more, because I have a list in my office, and it's now 2 pages long, and I just like have it hanging down, and I can't see anything behind it. But it's got all these books and the broadcast dates, and it keeps getting longer and longer. And I keep telling Rebecca, I can't do anymore. I can't read all this much, especially because I have to moderate the nonfiction book club at the bookstore, and all the other books that I want to read. So it's difficult. But enough of my whining. But also, if you want the complete schedule, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com. You can go to the radio station, WCHE1520.com, or the easiest way is to download our podcast, which is a cool site, Podomatic, or really the simplest is just going to iTunes. And if you have the app, just go to the podcast app. If not, just do the pull down menu on the left-hand side of iTunes that says podcasts, and then just type Avid Reader in the dialog box in the upper right of that page, and you'll just see them all scroll down. And there's some other things that are called the Avid Reader, but they aren't us. So anyway, we're up to like 520 shows. I don't know how long iTunes will let them hang there, but it's pretty cool. I printed out a list of them just so I would have some record. Plus, I have like 6 banker's boxes full of folders about each of these authors that I don't know what I'm going to do with. My children certainly aren't going to want them when I die. Anyway, I don't know why I'm babbling, but in any event, thanks as always for being here, and we look forward to having you here next week on the Avid Reader.